Welcome to the Democracy Group, a network of podcasts about democracy, civic engagement, and civil discourse. In this feed, you will find a sampling of episodes from our podcast and the Democracy Group, as well as recordings from our events. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please visit democracygroup.org to find more like this. Now let's get to our featured episode.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University. And today, I'm joined by Maxwell Stearns, author of the book Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. Max is a professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law and has written on the Constitution, the Supreme Court, and economic legal analyses. Max, welcome to The Politics Guys, and thank you for coming on to discuss your new book, Parliamentary America.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most fun things I think we get to do. Listeners really love to get a chance to dive into some of these works. And your book was very striking to me, Max. It is, to borrow your phrasing, an argument for advancing the most radical outcome possible. That is, ending of our two-party majoritarian system in the least radical way possible. But before we even get there, I think in the U.S., already we're going to, I just say that's kind of the goal of the book, in two-party majoritarian systems. And I feel like you're already going to have two sets of people who hear that, and they're going to think, one group's going to go, that's crazy. We have a stable system that's longstanding. And then another who's going to stand up and go, it's been time. It's time. And you kind of slowly reveal in the book that you maybe started in that first camp, but that in your words, quote, it's past time to recognize that to the extent of the story of our nation is exceptional, it's despite of, not because of, our constitutional design. Can you walk our listeners through what brought you as a constitutional scholar to write this book and to say, look, we need to fundamentally alter our constitutional design?
Absolutely. So I began teaching constitutional law in the period that sort of begins the information age. So I've been teaching since 1992, which dates me. And I taught constitutional law consistently with the way I think a lot of people who teach constitutional law go about the task, or did go about the task, at least in the period of the time that I began teaching, which is to talk about its seemingly endless, benign adaptability to changed historical circumstances. This was kind of the way one thought about the fact that we had a constitution that had been in place then for over a couple hundred years. We're getting closer to the quarter millennium point, that through a series of processes that included amending and more significantly judicial interpretations that allowed doctrine to evolve with changing conditions, that we had this system in place that really was the product of, sort of wisdom despite the early original sins. Obviously, the absolute tragedy and horror of bringing enslaved persons from Africa here and then holding them in the absolutely most horrific conditions, and our westward expansion at the expense of Native American persons. And in, I would say, the mid-teens, not my mid-teens, but the year, coinciding with what we'll call the rise of the Trump era, things that had long bothered me began to come to a head. And I began to realize that a lot of the stories that I had been told and that I had internalized and that I was passing on really weren't true. And that this notion of American exceptionalism was something that we really had to grapple with, and that it might have been the case that our nation survived and thrived in spite of, not because of, its unique constitutional design. It might be that the fact that we are relatively insulated from foreign threats, that we have a constant influx of immigrants, I already talked about slavery and Western expansion, that these things allowed us to survive and thrive, and that this is not the product of our constitutional design, especially when we think about the fact that the constitutional design never really operated as the framers of the Constitution envisioned. And as I began interrogating that and thinking more deeply about how the two-party system has so dramatically overtaken the vision that Madison had of checks and balances and separation of powers and federalism, and has been substituted with these rivalries between two parties that are just growing increasingly far apart, I was left to really begin to engage in introspection about whether some of these intuitions that I carried since childhood, and many of us did, even in the professions you are in, political science and constitutional law, whether we need to really interrogate them more deeply and think about how our system compares to others around the world.
Yeah, I really loved that. I also loved that you said, look, when we're thinking about this problem, we have to realize that all democracies have different kinds of problems. And I really love that you problematized that. But kind of at the heart of that, you know, when you get to the, as you say, maybe they weren't thinking about it properly, it's that they weren't thinking specifically about parties properly. And that leads us to things like in your book and things that I teach about in intro classes, right? The framers were not intending for parties to develop the way they did. That's what we end up with the 12th Amendment. You have a wonderful little section on that. But when getting back to the parties, you kind of call it the Goldilocks problem a couple of times, that there are many countries that you go through in your case studies and say, look, what we need to shoot for is more than our two parties. And we'll get to some of that in a minute, too. We also don't want to have too many. But in a big way, I can hear a lot of people who are reading, and I was thinking about it, I couldn't help but think of some famous individuals who might have just at that stage already said, I'm not sure. Like I think back, I can't help but think of Karl Popper, you know, in his famous 1988 Economist article, where he's clarifying his own book and saying, look, what's really important is the stability of those two parties, because that allows us, you know, in his words, not to worry so much about bad rulers, but to get rid of them without bloodshed, without violence. So what of, you know, again, the support has taken those kinds of view. Kind of walk us through your response to those who are going to then argue and say, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but actually that longstanding unique nature of the two-party system is actually a positive thing.
I will go through. Okay. So it's very, very interesting to think about the stability of our two-party system. You know, it's if you go back to the 1950s, there are a few interesting observations. One is that in the 1952 presidential election, or in the lead up to it, both of the major parties courted the same candidate, Dwight D. Eisenhower. That's unimaginable seeming today. There was an American Political Science Association study in that period of time, and it was a study of the two-party system. And the primary criticism then was that the parties didn't give meaningful choice to the electorate. They were insufficiently distinct.
They're the same, yeah.
And 5 years after that election, the economist Anthony Downs writes a book called The Economic Theory of Democracy. And The Economic Theory of Democracy sort of set up this idea that so many American voters have in their mind, this idea that we can cast our politics on a line, liberal to the left, conservative to the right, and these candidates are going to converge on the middle, and this is going to be the stability. And I think that there were periods in our history where that was true, and it's not surprising that Downs wrote the book in the 50s, in the aftermath of World War II. It's not surprising that he wrote the book then. But if you look, for example, at the Pew Research data from the beginning of the 1990s until now, what we see is that the parties now are bimodal, in the centers of those parties are growing increasingly far apart. And in the book, I explain that this has very much to do with hyperpartisan gerrymandering. It has a lot to do with the way we convey and receive news and news-like content. But to get to the question about stability, the problem with a two-party system in which we have parties that are growing so far apart that both sides now no longer credit the other side with evaluating common information and coming in good faith to a contrary resolution, instead believing that anybody who disagrees, anyone in the other camp, must lack basic intelligence or be evil, undermines our capacity of governance and undermines our social cohesion. And we no longer have the stability that people imagine that we had, even though there were periods in our history where we didn't have cohesion. We could talk about earlier periods in history, but we can identify somewhere where we did. But the point is that the stability is undermined by a two-party system that are growing further and further apart. And to your point about the Goldilocks principle, you can have the same instability in a regime that's hyper-fractionalized with too many parties, which is why I use Goldilocks, right? The idea of not too hot, not too cold, not too few parties, which is what we have in the UK had, and you could think Brexit, or too many parties like Italy or Brazil or Israel. And we have to achieve that sweet spot that most political scientists believe is somewhere between 4 and 8 parties, more choices than we have, but not so many that it's overwhelming and leads for a comparable opportunity for a small group to get a foothold and then take over the entire system.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things that I thought you laid out in a fascinating way, right? So the traditional model, as you're noting, is that idea that you're going to seek that median voter, and therefore you're going to have a convergence in the middle. But what you lay out in the first part of the book is that our two-party dynamic no longer ends up pushing parties towards that median voter, right? As you'd already noted, like with the APSA, instead, we are ending up with more ideologically extreme parties, and that forces you have the, you start kind of at the schoolyard model, but then you complicate that with this idea that when we kind of have a multidimensional teeter-totter, we start to see that the push of those ideological spectrums on the party force equal and opposite actions from the other party, and that's going to continue. So kind of walk our listeners through your multidimensional teeter-totter exam of, you know, why do we end up not with the median voter convergence, but, you know, why do we end up, as you put it early on, with parties pushing each other to those extremes along a number of different dynamics?
So the idea is we're used to thinking of our party politics, as we've been discussing, as existing on a single line. But political scientists demonstrate that the better way to think of it is that there are two axes of politics. One is what we can think of as economics and policy, which operates on a kind of left-right spectrum. The other one is culture and identity, which operates on a kind of north-south spectrum. And when you put those together, the upper right quadrant is what you could think of as conservative on policy, conservative on identity or culture, traditional Republicans. The upper left would be more liberal on economic policy, conservative on cultural identity. That's kind of a traditional understanding of populism. Lower left, you would have liberal on both economics and social identity. That's kind of your traditional Democrat. Lower right, you would have conservative on economics, liberal on social identity. And that's sort of a conventional understanding of libertarianism. And it's very interesting because political scientists for a very long time have asked the question whether it's a more effective electoral strategy for candidates to converge toward the median or whether they're better off campaigning stronger to the base. But what I use the teeter-totter, and I loved your use of the multidimensional teeter-totter, what I use that, it's lovely. What I use that to convey is that there's yet another strategy, right? Because even this analysis of whether you campaign toward the base or toward the median still assumes a single-dimensional line. And what I'm suggesting is that when you have a two-party system, you can think of a teeter-totter operating in the middle. And as Donald Trump gets on one side and pushes up toward populism, you know, it's Newton's third law of motion becomes our first law of politics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. It creates a really strong push on the other side to become more liberal on culture and identity norms. And so the other candidate's kind of forced to push down. But imagine if that weren't true. Imagine if we had a multi-party system where a candidate could get off the teeter-totter opposite Donald Trump unless the candidate wanted to. So maybe Bernie Sanders wants to take the ride toward more open culture and identity politics, but maybe somebody like Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden would prefer to be on a teeter-totter opposite John Kasich, who takes a more moderate position on social and cultural issues, but he is conservative on economic policy, and Biden and Hillary Clinton are liberal on economic policy. And you can imagine other teeter-totters occupying that two-dimensional space and voters having real choices, right? They would actually be able to find candidates who they genuinely, sincerely are happy to vote for instead of being admonished every 4 years to choose the lesser of two evils. But again, you don't want to have too many choices, but you have to have more choices than two. And what you have to do is devise a system that motivates those third parties to emerge, but actually creates conditions under which they can survive and thrive. And that's what I'm trying to explain in the book, what's necessary to achieve that.
And I want to get to that. But another piece, and you brought it up earlier in that answer, was the importance of gerrymandering. And that's something that, you know, the host and I, the politics guy, we've talked about a lot. And as I read this section, I couldn't help but hear one of our co-hosts, Ken Katkin, going, exactly right, exactly right, Max. That's exactly right. But you know, you say that your historic overview of its origins, kind of more scientific, that you also, of course, the more colorful name for it, but that this version of modern gerrymandering has radically changed the American two-party system, and you're the worst. So take listeners through that a little bit before you can move forward, which is kind of that abbreviated version of this, focusing on the red map and the prominent role I think that plays in your book's argument to need to stabilize a multiplicity of parties.
So I assume that the more colorful name that you're referring to is the title of the book by David Daley. Don't worry, I won't.
Well, I mean, listen, we could theoretically say it, but then we'd have to add some additional notes to that.
I do want to give credit for a phenomenal book that I hope your readers...
Yeah, it is Rat Bible, F for the
which is called Rat F. I think I could say that, right?
Yes, we can still be clean and say that for sure.
So that's what we're going to say, Rat F. And it's sort of the story of why your vote doesn't count. So we need to understand one thing, which is your listeners need to understand one thing. Gerrymandering's really old. It was named
where the name
after this
even comes from.
It was named after this guy named Eldridge Gerry. Note the hard G there, not the soft G, right? So he basically became governor of Massachusetts really early in our constitutional history, and he had been an anti-federalist. Then he becomes a governor of Massachusetts after the Constitution goes into place, and he draws up this district that's in the shape of a salamander. And somebody comes up with a portmanteau, gerrymander. Clever, huh? And so gerrymander is the term that we use to describe districts that spread the wealth of the party in power over as many districts as possible and then compress the voters in the out of power party into as few districts as possible. So it really is something that has been with us forever. But what changed, and what David Daley tells so beautifully in his book, is that after Barack Obama's 2008 election, Republican operatives figured out how to accomplish this with scientific precision in a way that was really, really effective. And what they did was they threw money at state legislative district races to turn enough state general assemblies that were either purple or blue red, knowing that state legislative assemblies, general assemblies, come up with the districting maps almost invariably for the House of Representatives. And so as those state legislatures turn red, they were able to turn their House districts red. And the consequence of red mapping was that we no longer choose our representatives. Our legislators, our representatives effectively choose us through these gerrymandered maps, and some blue states are doing it too, although there are particular reasons why red states are better at it. We could talk about that. But the basic idea is that in the general election, the vast majority of House election districts are not competitive. By contrast, in the primary election cycle or caucus election cycle, they are competitive. But the consequence there is that if the representative isn't delivering enough to the base of the party, there's a threat that the person will be primaried in scare quotes, meaning will be up against somebody who will give more to the base of the party. And the consequence of that hyper-partisan gerrymandering is to make make the two parties go further and further away from each other into the direction of their base. And that's what we're seeing. And that is what feeds the dysfunction, or at least a good part of the dysfunction that we observe in Congress. Take the Kevin McCarthy thing. Kevin McCarthy steps down. Everybody kind of knew that if we'd gotten the moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans together, they could have come up with something that would have worked. And that's not a trivial office, the Speaker of the House. It's second in line of succession to the president, right after the vice president. And yet it took a really long time for the Republicans to actually settle on Johnson. But the problem is that in our two-party system, the goal is to divide the opposition and keep your side intact. And that's mutual on both sides, which is why we end up with a dominant two-party system. And those mechanisms, those institutions disallow the kind of compromise that would enable governance in what political scientists refer to as the core, kind of the center location in that two-dimensional space. And what I'm trying to do in the book is create better institutions with more options and with parties facing greater competition so we can create coalitions that will govern in the core. And it very much relates to the problem of gerrymandering, the way I've structured it. But in any event, it's a terrific question.
Well, and I want to get to that part two and part three as well, but I have just one last question here, because in the book's argument is on the one hand, you've got the scientific gerrymandering is pushing us in this direction. We have the nature of the political party and the two system institutions pushing us. But then you have this third element, or maybe the second. It's sometimes I'm a little confused on that front, but I was drawn to it, which was that intersection of contemporary media pushing ideologically more extreme or to the base parties. And this appealed to me. This is my own area of research. I take a look at the presidency and political communication. Wrote a book called The Social Media Presidency a long time ago. But what you kind of effectively argue is, look, when you're on things like Facebook and Twitter where you're not paying for them, well, you're then the product, as the old saying goes. And so what matters most, those kinds of institutions, is engagement, not quality, as you put it. And this brings us to what we once would have called as political scientists into kind of these hyper-specialized echo chambers. So, talk listeners through that in that conflict between what you argue is the information age's social media ability to amplify the problem of gerrymandering.
So you've got it exactly right. You've obviously read the book.
Definitely. Listen, we, here in the Politics Guys, we read every page of your book before. I have no.
what a pleasure! And but you've got the dynamic exactly right. So the intuition is this: just as hyperpartisan gerrymandering produces this dynamic whereby instead of us choosing the politicians are choosing us, or our representatives are choosing us. The way we now get news and news-like content, media sources choose us rather than us choosing them. So how does that work? Well, the business model of social media, whether we're talking about Twitter, X, or we're talking about Facebook, Meta, the idea is that what these advertisers want are for those to whom they're advertising to be actively engaged and sort of glued to the screen. And when you think about that, in terms of the conveyance of news and news-like content, what keeps people to the screen is not sort of up-the-middle, thoughtful, careful, dispassionate analysis that exposes both sides of a story. And right, what actually keeps people committed to the screen is something that reinforces their priors, right? Tells them, affirms their commitment to their group or tribe, makes them feel like they are righteous people. But the alternative thing that keeps them on the screen is precisely the opposite, right? Stories that, you know, are from the perspective of the other side that may be equally unreliable, but that allows you and your teammates, if you will, to denigrate them as lacking basic intelligence or even as evil. And so the consequence is that the business model of social media tends to reward producers of news and news-like information that convey hyper-partisan content, which tends to be inconsistent with the reliability of that content. I spend a little bit of time in chapter 4, which is on the history of media, and it's a fascinating history, talking about the media bias chart created by a company called Adfontys Media. Full disclosure, the creator, Vanessa Otero, is a friend of mine, and I am on her board of advisors. But what that chart demonstrates is the striking tendency in danger of social media not to convey the content that is the most reliable and centrist, but rather to overwhelm readers with content that's hyper-partisan and very low on reliability. And that business model tends to produce the same dynamic whereby we end up having news sent to us rather than us choosing the news. And what I suggest is, or what I say is, that there's this synergistic effect, which is why I put together these stories, whereby the news media motivates readers to diverge into two camps. They motivate politicians to spread further. That they in turn motivate the media to continue to spread further. And you have this negative synergistic loop that is pushing our politics further and further apart and our culture further and further apart, feeding the dysfunction that we're observing in terms of the challenges of governance, but also the sort of seeds of distrust and discord that we experience so tragically in our society. And these are both parts of the same dynamic that emerges from the information age.
Yeah, and, you know, and I love that you do that. One of the things I do with my students is we do this activity where we see what we get on YouTube to try to understand how you can kind of get into these rabbit holes for on your attention, right? And so based on what they're doing with these dummy accounts, we can kind of predict where you're going to end up down the line. And I think sometimes it's easy, you know, when you're writing it in the book to say, oh, wow, that's nefarious. But it's not nefarious in the way that most people think. It's not as if you've got somebody behind the scenes going, oh, I'm going to push them politically. It's rather the fact, it's the actual algorithm itself.
That's so true.
Pushing us this way.
You've got it exactly right. And by the way, I did like the use of the echo chamber. You're absolutely right about that. But you're correct, right? In other words, it doesn't require, this is the thing, it doesn't require some evil person sitting behind pulling strings. It just requires an understanding of the business model, the profitability, what it is that advertisers want, and what it is the algorithm has to produce to feed those revenue sources from advertisers. So even if we set aside anything about personal motivation, the dynamics of social media are simply different than the dynamics of media that occurred in periods where we had a more cohesive society, like going back when we were talking about the 50s.
Now, I really love part two of your book. You know, you call it the world tour, but I saw it as being kind of a nice targeted democratic comparative case studies. that's what I felt.
Well, I hope you won't mind my continuing to market it in terms of the world tour.
No, you need to. That was the right way. But I always love it when, you know, a fellow academic can take something that is maybe a little bit of we have our insider lingo and label it better. I loved that. We're going to go on this world tour. That was great, by the way. That was great.
And I like to think of myself as a pretty fun tour guide. I point out some nice sites along the way.
You do. You're thinking about like the location and the space. But I'm going to pause on part two for a minute, because I think for listeners, I'm not sure if they're going to quite get part two until we talk about your actual electoral reforms and maybe kind of point to your case studies to understand how we get to those reforms. And the reforms you get into in the book, they're both relatively simple in one sense. They're not as complex as some of the individuals we've had on the show in the past. But they are profound, and so I want to walk through what you propose to listeners. Your big one, your first electoral reform amendment, as you put it, is going to be you're going to double the size of the House from 435 to 870. And that doubling of the side serves this really kind of particular purpose, which is going to come up later, but I'll save that for you, to create a space for a second ballot to be based on proportional representation. So that is where you're voting for particular parties instead of individual members in single member districts. But, and this is kind of key, is that you're going to keep the 435 remaining single member districts so that maybe to make this a little bit more palatable. Like you go over that in chapter 7. So that's one of your proposals. And your second proposal is you're going to change how the president is selected, and not by moving it to a direct election, which we've heard a lot of from, but to another kind of indirect election via a parliamentary selection in that new 870-member House of Representatives. And then finally, you're going to create this new mechanism for ending the presidency by a 60% no-confidence vote, but not a simple one like in many parliamentary systems, but one for you call maladministration, kind of a space higher than that normal no confidence vote, but lower than that remaining impeachment vote. And so as I hear those amendments, you'll notice I've been talking just not that many months ago, we had Term Limits USA here on the show. And obviously they go a different direction than you in terms of what they want to be as though. We've had members talking about ranked choice voting, which is something else that you combat. So take listeners through, you know, why do we have these three, especially when, for those of us who've been listening, they've heard some alternatives and ones that you reject, again, like term limits, like ranked choice voting.
So let me start with the end of the question and then come to the beginning of the question. And I just say to your listeners that you really did a fabulous job synopsizing my proposals. So thank you for that. Just terrific. So let me say this. There is a strong intuition among many reformers that the thing to be avoided is amending the Constitution. You know, all we have to do is come up with something else, come up with a thing, the obvious thing that just if we tweak it, it solves the problem. So it actually is not true that we could impose term limits without amending the Constitution as a result of a Supreme Court case called Thornton from 1996. We would have to amend the Constitution for that. So let's set that aside, although I'll come back to it in a moment. Ranked choice voting, multi-member districts, these are two really prominent proposals that are getting a lot of attention these days, and term limits, right? Think about what they are designed to accomplish. What they're designed to do is to take our very partisan legislative body, the House of Representatives, let's just focus on the House, and this has parallels to the Senate, and basically get rid of them in favor of other people who would be more moderate. That's really what we're trying to do. Now let's look at the history of amending in American constitutional law. Every single amendment we've ever had has come from Congress. There are two ways to amend the Constitution. You can either call a constitutional convention by order of two-thirds of the states, or two-thirds of each House of Congress can propose an amendment. In either case, three-quarters of the states have to ratify. All right. So it is a really high bar to amend. But we've never had a constitutional convention. We've come close in the 60s and 80s. We're within one state or two states. But let's assume it has to come from Congress, because it always has come from Congress. Imagine asking members of the House of Representatives to propose a series of amendments the literal purpose of which is to render them unemployed.
Yeah.
Right? Here is the House of Representatives Unemployment Act. We would like you to float that to the states. I don't think that's an easy sell. And I actually think that the mistake is to imagine that the bar for enactability of reform is amending. The bar for enactability of reform is not having a set of proposals that actually continues to empower the people who can block the reform. My proposal is the only proposal that leaves intact each member of the House and Senate in their existing districts or states. So actually, my proposal allows people that we may not like. A lot of people don't like Congress. We may not like these people, but imagine we have a constitutional convention, and imagine that convention offers up the proposals that you and I have just discussed. My proposal lets the House and the Senate become the heroes of democracy with a pressure release valve where they can say, yeah, you got all those ideas. We have better ideas. We have three amendments that, number one, it will actually end our constitutional crisis. By the way, none of those things would actually end our constitutional crisis. And that can be enacted because it will gain their support in comparison with everything else that is out there. And So let me back up and talk about why ranked choice voting doesn't do the things that people think it will do. Ranked choice voting operates on a premise, and I'm going to get a little bit technical, but I think your readers will follow me. I think most of your listeners can follow me. I think most listeners understand the notion of a standard distribution, right? A statistician would call it a Gaussian distribution. It looks like a bell curve. Everybody kind of has that in their head, right, of a bell curve. And the idea of ranked choice voting is that we want to allow people who are on the extremes of our politics, whether to the left or to the right, to be able to first choice pick the extreme candidate and then gradually move to the center. Have folks on the other side will do it in the opposite way, gradually get to the center. Okay, it sounds lovely. The problem is that the whole problem with our politics is that we don't have a standard distribution.
Right.
We have what's called a bimodal distribution. And the problem is that the way ranked choice voting works in the most standard rendition is called instant elimination voting. So what that means is that people rank their choices, and the candidate who gets the fewest votes is then knocked out, and then you reassess the ballots. The people who voted for the one that got knocked out, they get reassigned. The lowest vote getter gets knocked out. You keep repeating it until a majority candidate wins. The problem is that people who support ranked choice voting think that that gets you to this middle outcome, this median outcome, but actually it doesn't. And that's not a theoretical point. I mean, it is a theoretical point, but it's actually also an empirical point. If you look at the interim House election in Alaska that produced Peltola, it turns out that there were three principal candidates. There was Peltola, a liberal Democrat, Bacik, a moderate conservative, and of course, Sarah Palin, a conservative. It turns out that if a certain percentage of Palin voters had literally stayed home, what would have happened is Palin would have been knocked out. There would have been a choice between Bacik and Peltola. And Bacik, who was the moderate candidate in that field, would have won. But instead, because it was a bimodal distribution, Bacik got the fewest votes and got knocked out. As between Palin and Peltola, Peltola won. I'm not saying anything negative about Peltola. I'm simply pointing out that when you have a bimodal distribution, ranked choice voting doesn't do what everybody thinks it does. It just speeds up the same problems that we have now of getting you one of your extreme candidates. And that's not a problem to be solved. That is the problem to be solved. It just speeds it up. We get it more quickly. Well, we're not looking for the same problems more quickly. We're looking to solve the problem. So what I propose that we do is we allow everybody to keep their gerrymandered seats, but we double the House. So the idea is when you vote in the House of Representatives, you'll cast two ballots. One of them is going to be in a districted election, just like you do now, and it's likely to lead to two dominating parties for the reasons we talked about before. The goal in winning is keep your side intact, fracture the opposition. It's mutual, two parties. But your second ballot's going to be by party. So let's say that you're a Democrat, but you're really progressive. So you want the Democratic Party to form a coalition with the progressives, vote progressive. Let's say you're a GOP, you're a conservative, but you just really, really don't like MAGA. You might have your party ballot be for the GOP, or it might be for the Democratic Party. You might think maybe we could have a grand coalition of centrist Democrats and centrist Republicans. You can play this out in any number of ways. The idea is that you suddenly are able to convey with great precision what it is you want. You're able to convey which party is going to lead the coalition and the direction in which you want the coalition to go. It's very simple at the level of retail politics. Cast two ballots. This is what I want the coalition to do. Unlike today, where you've got a choice between two candidates, and we know who it's going to be now, Biden, and it's going to be Trump. 63% of voters don't want either of them to run. So people instinctively think, I've got power, I get to vote for the president. Well, you don't have power if you don't have the choices that you want. What I want to do is give voters more power, because they'll be able to affect the choices that become available for multiple party coalitions to form. And so the first, so what I do is I take the party ballots on a state by state basis, and I use it to create proportional delegations for each state. And then we end up with 870 members of the House of Representatives. And then in the Second Amendment, in descending order of representation, the party with the most seats, up to five parties, will negotiate until a majority coalition forms with a backstop. So we don't have the problems of these parliamentary systems that never get to a result. That's not going to be a problem in this system because there's a backstop. And I do have that removal provision. And those parties that succeed in forming a coalition will have their pre-designated slate for president and vice president assume those offices. And so people will know which parties are going to be responsible for which slates and what the results will be. But the real benefit of this is, let's say that you vote for the Progressive Party, and let's say the Progressive Party forms part of the coalition. When the party does that, when it forms a coalition with the moderate Republicans or with the moderate Democrats, it's going to say, we'll join your coalition if, and it's what follows the if you give us these policy concessions, if you give us these appointments to the cabinet, if the first time there's a seat on the Supreme Court, you give us that seat. And so those third parties suddenly have a role in forming the government. But more than that, voters get rewarded for voting for those third parties, because when those third parties become part of a governing coalition, they give something of value to their constituents. They're not operating as they are now as spoilers or as randomizers. And so suddenly you've really got viable third parties that play a vital role in forming the government. Voters are rewarded for supporting them, and they are rewarded for joining the coalition. And if they fail to play a game that allows them to form part of a coalition, they're going to be replaced with parties who can. And that's the way it should be. Ineffective parties should be replaced with effective parties. That's the way politics should be played out.
And I'll tell you, I was really refreshing. You were talking about it in terms of, you know, one, when we had Term Limits USA on here, right? They want to go the route of having a constitutional convention. And I pushed them repeatedly, like, what was the likelihood of that actually happening? You know, and that's always kind of, you know, wiped away. And likewise here, you know, you didn't say it explicitly right here, but right, you're not changing the Senate either, right? So the Senate remains the same. As a matter of fact, it even gains a power in your system, right?
It's going to get the ability. Indeed, it
does. Yeah,
absolutely right. And let me just add this comment, Trey. I mean, I will say this. I say it in the book. The Senate is the single most anti-democratic institution in any country that purports to be a democracy anywhere in the world, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
So extreme that a Wyoming voter has the equal voting power for the U.S. Senate as 67 Californians. That's pretty remarkable. And the lowest 21 population states with 42 representatives in the Senate, 42 senators in the Senate, so 42%, right? That population equals California, which has 2%. It's an outrageously anti-democratic institution. But in my view, once we're in an effective multi-party system, we can work with it. Because what's going to happen is, although we will end up with two parties dominating separate Senate races for the same reasons we've gone through, each side wants to keep its side intact and fracture the opposition, it doesn't mean we're going to have the same two parties across the country. Different combinations of two parties will emerge as dominant. And so the Senate becomes a multi-party institution over time, and it's going to work with the House in order to be effective. It's going to have an incentive to be effective. And once we have a functional, thriving multi-party democracy, I've got a whole list of other reforms I'd love to see enacted, but the goal of the book is expressed in the subtitle, The Least Radical Means of Radically Reforming Our Broken Democracy. Let's become a functional democracy. A functional multi-party democracy. Then we could think of other reforms that might affect the Senate, that might affect the Supreme Court. But the first thing we have to do is become a highly functional democracy, which we can.
Yeah, and I think that makes your argument, especially as you go into part book, you know, less of the academic pipe and something where you're trying to be meaningful in that go. But one area where, you know, when I got done with the book, I was still scratching my head just a little bit. And so I'm curious about you on this one was, you know, as a presidency scholar, it didn't appear clear to me how you overcome the issue of presidential government. And what I mean to say by that is, of course, you don't need the president to sign off on an amendment to get it ratified. But politically, as you mentioned in the book, in terms of party, if sitting presidents didn't want an amendment, his or her party are going to be pretty unlikely to pursue it. And in the modern American system, you know, we have come to use the presidency primarily through unilateral actions and powers to make kind of big changes in policy. And that allows the party that wins the presidency a lot of power. But it also conversely allows Congress an important thing, and that's the ability to campaign against all of those actions that presidents take. And so when you put together the scholarship of congressional scholars like Richard Mayhew with the work of presidential scholars like Howe, you see the desire, you know, for presidents to have power. They bypass the gridlock created by Congress, and then Congress, though, gets the ability to run against them. But your system would seemingly unravel that dynamic, in part because it takes away the electoral college for the president. How do you get the parties to get on terms of the presidency? That was the one piece of the book where I just thought, I felt a little bit lacked. I was wondering if you could respond a little bit to that. That was the one area where I thought, I'm not sure that you're going to get the president's. I mean, for example, if Donald Trump wins, I can't imagine Trump, even if the Republican Party was on board, wouldn't do what he kind of did with immigration and say, don't do it. What do you say to that?
So let me just say, I think if Donald Trump wins, we're in deep trouble as a democracy, because he has revealed himself to be committed to the erosion of democratic norms. And, you know, I'll plug another book, the Ziblatt-Levitsky book, How Democracies Die. I don't think we're looking ahead to a constitutional crisis. One of the main insights of their book is that you can be in crisis for years or even decades, because, you know, a lot of people think that democracies die in some spectacular military fashion, when in fact they die through the gradual erosion of longstanding and agreed upon democratic norms. And unfortunately, tragically, one of the two parties has been sort of taken over by a leader who has demonstrated a willingness and actually desire to erode longstanding democratic norms. So that is a profound problem. But I want to come back to this idea, because I actually believe that in many respects, this will strengthen the presidency. And the reason I say that is because there will be more competition to be in the coalition, right? In other words, I have a deliberately high bar for the removal for maladministration. And it's 60%.
That's something I want to come into
mid.
Please.
So the president has a little bit of cover. In other words, the fact that the president might go in a slightly different policy direction isn't going to be enough to remove the president, and there's more fluidity in the coalition in the House. If, for example, in an off-presidential election cycle, we can end up with a dynamic where you know, the party coalition structure could change, and we might end up with a bit of an impasse similar to what we have now, although it'll be actually be much less than what we have now. But I actually think that there are two important aspects of this. One is that the president has the capacity in a multi-party coalition system to reach out to other parties prospectively to come into the coalition. And the other part of it is that the coalition has a greater capacity to hold the president accountable, because removing the president actually doesn't necessarily end the leadership of the coalition. There's somebody else who is next in line, who has been selected to be part of that coalition. In other words, I think it will to some extent diminish the cult of personality problem, but it will actually strengthen checks and balances and separation of powers. And I think that we see that in other systems that actually operate this way. The critical difference between parliamentary governance and presidential governance is the time at which the coalition forms. So in presidential systems, the coalitions form within the parties prior to the general election. In parliamentary systems, when they're effective and you have multiple parties, more than two, but not too many more than two, the coalitions get negotiated among the parties that exist in typically the lower legislative body. And we're gonna, in the way I've set it up, the winner, the party leading the coalition, will have its pre-designated slate chosen. Now, those candidates may, or those parties, some of them, may continue to operate with caucuses and primaries for their leadership. So we still may observe the kinds of campaigns we're seeing now, but there may be other parties, smaller parties, that may choose tighter methods because of cost considerations, financing considerations, to use a more streamlined means of choosing who is at the top of the ticket if they end up being the parties that negotiate the coalitions. I don't mean to say there won't be a change in the dynamics between the president and Congress, because the point of the book is to produce a change in those dynamics. I want to be clear about that. But what I'm trying to do is create a system whereby the members of one of two parties are not entirely dependent for their career advancement on the grace of the sometimes most ungraceful leaders of parties, because there will be more competition for the occupant, right? When you've got a multi-party coalition, you may actually have members of different parties in the cabinet, right? And that will be negotiated. What you can't change in my system, because I want to make sure we have a stable, predictable government, is we can't begin negotiating who it is who's going to be at the top of each party's ticket. That's something that the parties are going to commit themselves to, so that if they are the party that wins the negotiation, their candidates occupy the presidency and vice presidency. But I think, Trey, that it'll still be the case that in the presidential election cycle, so every other two-year election, just like we have now, same calendar as we have now, that you will see candidates campaigning direct to the people, but the campaign's going to take a different form. Instead of denigrating one other party as the product of somebody who's fundamentally incompetent, who has nothing valuable to add, in order to be a successful candidate now, you're going to have to actually campaign on a willingness and even enthusiasm to join forces with other party leaders, despite the fact that you don't agree with them on everything. Right. And I think that's what's going to fundamentally change the dynamics of our elections. And I think, and I'm not Pollyannish. I'm not suggesting we're all suddenly going to sing Kumbaya. But I think over time, that's going to filter into our culture. We're going to realize, you know what? I don't have to agree with other people on everything to realize that we can do common projects together, even something as important as the common project of governance in a democracy. And let me just say, that's actually what the framers thought they were doing. It just isn't what they did. And so that particular goal was actually an important goal. They just didn't create the right institutional mechanisms to achieve it. We just know more today. That's the reason for the World Tour. We can actually see how other systems do that better.
I love it. You know, I had not thought really about that point you made at the end, the idea that you would not be able to have exclusionary language about the other parties in your orbit because you don't know with whom you may end up having to have that coalition. That's an excellent kind of point. Well, Max, it has been absolutely wonderful talking about your book, Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy or in the Politics Guys. I've absolutely loved it. And the book is available now, correct?
It is available now.
And for all the outlets that you're normally used to thinking of, so you can go and head that. But you were telling me before we had hopped on the show that they're here shortly is going to be coming, as many of our listeners are always curious about, an audiobook version, correct?
There will indeed. In the middle of April, I'm going to be recording it myself. I will be the narrator of the book. And when that's out, it'll be available on all the usual audiobook channels. Right now, the book itself is available on at all the usual outlets, both as a hardcover book. And I know there's a Kindle version, too. So you can get it wherever you buy your books. Online, whether it's Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you can get it direct from the publisher, Johns Hopkins, or HFS, which supports independent bookstores, all of the usual places.
And again, that is Maxwell Stern's Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. Max, thank you so much for being on The Politics Guys.
It was an absolute pleasure.
Listen, if you're not already a supporter of The Politics Guys, we hope you'll consider becoming one because without you, we can't keep this podcast going. And you get all kinds of really cool stuff like this episode without any of those advertisements. You also get access to things like our Politics Guys Discord group. There's even Politics Guys gear and other benefits at different levels of support. To check it out, head to patreon.com/politicsguys. You can also support us on Venmo, where we're at Politics Guys, and of course through PayPal. All of those are in the links, the show notes, or you can head old school to politicsguys.com/support. If you'd like access to those midweek shows that we do, but you're not in a position to financially support the podcast, I get it. I've got three kiddos. Please just email us at mail@politicsguys.com, and we can get you set up. Whether you're a supporter or not, we'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe, rate, and review us on whatever podcast app you use. And I am sure that Max would say the same thing for his book through this source that you were purchasing it for. It means a lot to all of us. If you've got questions or comments for Max or any of us here on The Politics Guys, please feel free to email us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, you can find all of those links in the show notes. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode this weekend, and I hope you'll join us then.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the Democracy Group. If you want more podcasts like this, then visit democracygroup.org. There you will find our events, topics, and a newsletter as well. So head on over to democracygroup.org.